This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
There were responses to the survey left via phone messages, called in by listeners, emails, and given verbally at the station. These responses, split pretty evenly for and against the Hartman Show, were not included in the online results. However, next time we will have a secure way for listeners and members to respond who do not have access to a computer. This was just an information gathering survey, the results of which are now being turned over to the Programming Committee for discussion. The next meeting of the Program Committee will be Tuesday, July 9th at 6 p.m. at KBOO. Thanks again for your thoughtful comments, suggestions, and remarks associated with the survey and what you think should be aired on KBOO. This has been Lynn Fitch.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com. This program has also been made possible in part by Friends of KBOO, supporting locally produced, organically grown, homemade programming for Portland and the world. Thanks, KBOO, for 45 years of music, current affairs, and live broadcasts. Friends of KBOO can be reached at 503-788-2533.
I wish I was mold in the ground. I wish I was mold in the ground. If I was mold in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. I wish I was mold in the ground. Well, I'm glad I'm not standing on the top. I'm glad I'm not standing on the top. If I was standing on the top, I'd be sure to fall off. I'm glad I'm not standing on.
Good morning, Cascadia. I am Joe Clement, your host for the anarcho-syndicalist commie-pinko-freak variety hour. That is the Old Mole variety hour. The Old Mole brings you an hour of agitation, education, and inoculation, the first three principles of the AEIOU organizing model used by the industrial workers of the world. Agitation for getting stirred to action, or at least connecting the dots. Education as to the social and material underpinnings of inequality, oppression, and exploitation. And inoculation with regard to neoliberal cynicism and other diseased ways of thinking that proliferate in these the waning days of Babylon. The last two, O and U, refer to organizing and unionizing, but you're going to have to do that for yourself. What we can do for you on today's Old Mole is bring you an interview with Old Mole Bill Resnick and U of O sociologist John Bellamy Foster about revolutionary strategy in the context of environmental degradation and how that ultimately means moving away from growth toward a steady state economy. Kara Dugas reviews a new documentary about cultural appropriation by white hip-hop artists called Blacking Up, Hip-Hop's Remixing of Race and Identity. Tom Becker reads a Truthout article titled Mankind, Death by Corporation, which locates Monsanto in a legacy of death-dealing capitalist industries like tobacco, lead, and asbestos. Throughout the show, we'll hear music and spoken word pieces that include acoustic punks crying out for the Susquehanna River and a kind of modern take on Phil Oakes' Love Me, I'm a Liberal, as well as how you too can get the feds to plow up your garden just in time for planting, and why you also shouldn't work for the NSA. Again, you're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. We now turn to Bill Resnick and John Bellamy Foster on strategies for reshaping the economy.
John Bellamy Foster, welcome to KBOO.
Glad to be here from Eugene to Portland.
Yes, John Bellamy Foster teaches at the University of Oregon. He also edits the journal Monthly Review. Increasingly over the last 10 years or so, it's been warning that a continuation of current economic arrangements, and that is capitalist arrangements, will so devastate the planet's environment as to threaten human extinction, at least kill billions of people. More recently, Monthly Review has done more work on addressing how to avoid this calamity, and you've done a lot of that work yourself, proposing a combined short-term and longer-term strategy. Tell us about your work.
The seriousness of the global ecological crisis is so great that what we really need is an ecological and social revolution. We have to transform the nature of human society. And this isn't just me. It's the Royal Society in England, the oldest scientific body in the world, just came up with a statement saying that we have to create a new economy not geared to expansion and to consumption. The problem is that we're facing within decades really serious tipping points, particularly related to climate change. But climate change is only part of the global ecological crisis. There's other problems such as ocean acidification, destruction of the ozone layer, species extinction, the loss of fresh water, loss of land cover, pollution, and so on. And scientists are pretty clear about the fact that we're crossing planetary boundaries and that we have to do things very quickly. We have a problem because we have to act quickly, but we live in a society that's geared to economic expansion where profits are more important than anything else, where we're spending $1 trillion a year on marketing, getting people to buy things that they don't really want. And the social forces are very weak. The governments are not doing anything. How do we respond to such a serious threat? So we have to come up with a short-term strategy that is feasible within the context of where we're at in the society as a sort of a stopgap solution to prevent us, for example, hitting the climate change tipping point. And we need a long-term response, which would be an ecological revolution or ecological and social revolution.
What do you see as the best, the most likely to succeed effort as a stopgap to buy time to ensure that tipping points aren't reached?
Well, first of all, scientists have designated a global average temperature of 2 degrees Celsius as the boundary. And we basically have to stay below 2 degrees Celsius in order to protect the climate and humanity and most species on the Earth. But we're approaching 2 degrees Celsius very quickly. Now, and what science is saying is that 2 degrees is the point of no return or the point of irreversible climate change. Is sometimes referred to as the tipping point. And why that is important is that essentially they're saying that if we get to 2 degrees Celsius, we lose our capacity to get back to the level of the climate that represents long-term stability and a safe space for humanity. And things will basically rocket up out of our control at that point. You can't put the Antarctic ice back when it melts. You can't put the Arctic back. That means that we have to take some actions really quickly. We need to lower carbon emissions by something like 5% a year, at least over 2.5% a year. In the rich countries, we should be reducing carbon emissions by 10% a year. But economists usually say, well, they'll reduce it by even 1% is to create an economic crisis. So there's very serious blockages to doing anything.
With the short-term strategy, we'll continue, but probably at a much slower rate, the buildup of carbon in the environment. Am I right then that your long-term strategy is to, as these struggles are going on, move towards not just eliminating the use of coal and some of the, quote, unconventional fuels, and also reducing all carbon use. But still, you would need a long-term strategy for building an economy that was not filling the planet with carbon dioxide. Is that right?
Yeah, well, there are a number of things here. First of all, climate change isn't our only problem, so we need a long-term strategy with respect to climate change, but we need a long-term strategy with respect to the entire environmental problem, of which climate change is only a small part, and there are all sorts of other boundaries that we're crossing and we're approaching disastrous results. But it's becoming increasingly complex as time gets short. The strategies of what to do and what will enable us to act fast enough and effectively enough. Kevin Anderson, who is one of the leading climate scientists. He argues that time is so short that we're going to have to put a moratorium on economic growth because we can't solve this problem while having economic growth. Because if you try to solve the problem by increasing efficiency, economic growth means that you have to be even more efficient. It just can't be done, he says, to avoid the tipping point at this stage while having economic growth. Of course, our society is based on the accumulation of capital and expansion of the economy. That in itself says we have to talk about different economic relations, but he's saying essentially, we put a moratorium on economic growth for several decades, at least, in order to deal with this problem. And he says that we need to have massive rationing in order to shift towards conservation. And we have to be able to divert our resources. We need to turn to renewable energies, but to create a renewable energy infrastructure would require a lot of fossil fuels to do that. Ironically, in order to create the renewable energy infrastructure, we need to increase our use of fossil fuels. The main answer at this point is drastic conservation and a reorganization of our society as fast as we can. Most of what we produce in the society is waste. Every product you buy is probably more waste than use value. You have to buy all this plastic and garbage and basically, the sales costs have penetrated into the production process so that most of the costs of production are really have to do with sales. And that's why we use so much packaging. That's why we use so much plastic. We produce enough plastic every year to cover the entire United States in saran wrap. And do we need this? Can we reorganize things? Can we lead different lives? Can we create a new transportation system? But we can't make the changes probably that we need to make without some drastic conservation, limits on economic growth, a whole different way of consuming. We need drastic action. In the United States, in the Second World War, the automobile production shifted from the production of automobiles to production of tanks and planes. Completely shifted over in 6 months, and we had rationing and so on. We probably need a kind of a, quote, wartime basis for the society where we institute massive conservation, rationing, redistribution of resources, reorganization of the society, and so on. But there's no sign that anything like that's going to happen. And it seems almost ridiculous to talk about it at times since we're not doing anything, at least in this country. But you have to talk about it because the consequences of hitting 2 degrees Celsius are just too great for us to not talk about it. We're talking about, in some ways, the very survival of humanity and most species on the planet.
In thinking about it, sometimes it's easy to get depressed by the magnitude of it. On the other hand, thinking about it politically and what's likely to become more and more clear to people, even parts of the capitalist class, like let's say Mayor Bloomberg, who recognizes that New York City is in very deep trouble from climate change. It seems to me that what we see are sort of the dawning of those recognitions, but of course within capitalism as well. And one could imagine, it seems to me, the beginnings of some kind of block where the insurance companies and the intelligent capitalists begin to recognize that this is a greater threat than World War II and begin moving towards promoting a war footing. And if enough of them do that, even capitalist media is probably going to join them in the same way that World War II led to this great national consensus about the need to protect ourselves and to take control of the economy and run it as a sort of war-fighting machine, which was, you know, wildly successful.
Yeah, I think that the mobilization of the population would lead to enormous changes if these issues entered into people's lives. And they realized they needed to do something about it, both for their lives and their children and their grandchildren, and people got engaged in the struggle. I thought that the Hansen plan, where there would be the carbon fee and then most of the population would actually start getting additional income because their carbon footprints were below the average, this would encourage people to lower their carbon footprints and would get everybody involved in thinking about it. The one geoengineering strategy is to paint all the roofs in the world white because we're losing the Arctic and we need more reflectivity. And I really don't know how much that would help, but the idea of everyone doing something and recognizing it was a crisis would change things dramatically. And, yeah, something like a World War II mobilization, but the problem there is that the mobilization for war actually was consistent with the expansion of profits and economic growth. And here we have the more difficult problem that if we try to solve this, and we've waited so long, if we expand the economy, then we actually end up emitting more carbon, and we speed up the problem. We head faster towards the tipping point. So we really need solutions where we reorganize society and redistribute resources while also not expanding the economy. And this is something that capitalism, it's unthinkable for this system, for those in power in the system. We have a system that's less democratic than ever before. People widely recognize now that we live in a plutocracy and not a democracy. This isn't a new thing, but it's become so much more extreme that it's becoming universally recognized. Well, how do you get a society like that to move in the general interest?
Let me give you a hypothesis. It seems to me when this moment comes when even much of the leadership who wants to retain capitalism, to be sure, and wants to reconstruct in their interest as well, at least not losing power and profit, and in fact the country mobilizes this enormous mobilization. In World War II, the mobilization did in fact entail a tremendous amount of popular sacrifice, not capitalist sacrifice. People were in fact willing to both conserve and live on less, although, of course, World War II created jobs for all. It seems to me that once that mobilization occurs, it's going to very quickly provide an opportunity for the left to talk about what the real needs are and the need to reconstruct the economy on a democratic basis with far less production of junk and even more kinds of production that are restorative of the environment rather than destructive of it, which was quite possible in agriculture and forestry and many other areas. It seems to me that's a relatively hopeful scenario.
There's two things in what you mentioned. First of all, in the history of revolutions, often the split starts at the top. That's what happened with the French Revolution, for example. The aristocracy basically revolted against the monarchy, and then the whole third estate was brought into it. But the revolt started at the top. I can conceive of, under these circumstances, a large section of the ruling class or the capitalist class or those who are near that level, below the 1%, breaking away and deciding that they need to protect the environment and putting this even above the economic goals and profit. There's a certain section of those at the top of the elite who could well break away, and we see aspects of this. But the real change will only come when the whole population is involved and is mobilized. And the great danger from the standpoint of those who control this society, and it does have a ruling class and a power elite, the great danger of mobilizing the population to deal with this problem is that the population is going to say, well, we'll change this and we'll change that. And they're going to go after the whole production and social structure, which actually needs to be done, but then it really would be revolutionary if it got to a certain point. But that's what we need. Actually, I talk about a short-term strategy and a long-term strategy, but they really have to meld into one. We have to recognize that we can't just call for ecological social revolution then, given the short time span. We have to talk about, okay, what can we do in the context of the society as it is that would be sufficient to prevent us from hitting this tipping point? But that actually has to meld into a long-term strategy, which would necessarily be a left strategy of ecological social transformation. How do we change the way we live, our transportation, our communities, what we produce and what we consume? How do we create a society that's qualitative instead of simply quantitative? How do we recognize that mostly what we're working to produce is waste in various forms? How do we reduce our working time and maybe even lower productivity rather than raise productivity? It isn't necessary to work people to death. We have enough affluence in the society. So we could make the changes, and we could gear things more to a sustainable society and people's real need. But that would be an ecological and social revolution. And I think what we need is a short-term strategy that's sufficient, that also points us in the direction of transforming the whole society, create a more sustainable order.
Let's conclude, John Bellamy Foster, with just a summary of what you've talked about. First is this short-term strategy for buying time, but simultaneous with that is, for a left at least, is a long-term strategy that both does critique but also pushes in the direction of when mass mobilization occurs, it goes way beyond what the elites are thinking about and begins imagining and building a society that would be an alternative to capitalism's wasteful production and would move towards both sustainability and democracy, it seems to me, and better lives for everybody. Part of our task, I guess, is to begin also thinking about those alternatives and promoting their feasibility and moving from the abstract notions to actually being able to point out people who are living ecologically and in ways that are both richer and that protect the environment.
Well, it's not a question of just people who are living more ecologically. We can. I mean, there are people involved in small organic agriculture, which is actually more productive than is agribusiness. But we can't solve these problems by individuals living green shopping or individuals going back to the land and so on. We can learn from these things and we can use them to build a new kind of society, but our problems are political in the sense that we have to socially organize to generalize these forms in the society as a whole. People say, well, technology will allow us to live with the kind of society that we have, that technology will solve the climate problem. Technology itself, the kinds of technologies that we have, they won't solve the problem. But we have all the technologies we need. We have solar and wind power. We have all the technologies we need to create a better society. What we need to do, though, to really make it work is we have to change our social relations. We have to change the way we live, and we have to get back to community instead of an individualistic dog-eat-dog society. We have to get away from what Curtis White calls capitalism's barbaric heart and get back to the real heart of community. So we have a lot to do. I like to tell people that it's possible, I mean more than possible really, as we all know, that we won't be able to stop this and we will reach the tipping point and things will really go downhill for humanity very rapidly and for other species. But what we will have to do then is exactly what we have to do now, but under worse circumstances. The answer then, just like the answer now, is to create a more sustainable society, a more community-oriented society geared to human needs. It'll require social and ecological planning on a democratic basis, and we need to change the nature of our production and consumption. So we know what we have to do. It's just we are not mobilized to do it, and we all feel disempowered, and we feel that we can't stop this train that's going over the cliff, a runaway train. But we have to, because we don't really have any choice, because the consequences now are too big for humanity. You can't be in tune with your humanity without resisting this. So, yeah, I think the long-term strategy is really what we have to focus on, but we also need to think about, okay, what can we do right now to prevent ourselves from breaking the carbon budget, as we say. And we really only have so many carbon emissions we can put up in the atmosphere, a trillion tons, and then basically, it's all over. We've lost our control over the process. We've initiated irreversible changes that we will not be able to do anything about. So we just are facing some ultimate limits.
John Bellamy Foster, thanks for all of your work. There are great struggles ahead, but we can't look only to the ones ahead. There are the ones that are occurring now. We have to work in them in ways that make the coming struggles such that we can prevail in those. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Right. So long.
Oh, Susquehanna. You are tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm your host, Joe Clement. That was from Defiance Ohio's Great Depression album, The Great Depression, which was released in the Bush era. Before that, Bill Resnick was talking with John Bellamy Foster about the need for social revolution, including radical reduction of consumption and breaking the spell of economic growth. You can hear that interview in a day or two by going to the Old Mole webpage on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Now we turn to Kara Dugas, who is going to review a new documentary called Blacking Up, Hip-Hop's Remixing of Race and Identity, which critically interrogates hip-hop's popularity among white youth with an eye towards histories of cultural appropriation. Kara?
A fascinating documentary from 2009 entitled Blacking Up, Hip-Hop's Remix of Race and Identity, addresses the implication and roots of white people in hip-hop culture. The film's director and producer, Robert A. Clift, wants to know, is white participation in hip-hop a sign that we're progressing forward culturally, or is it a mockery of black culture? Clift has a background in documentaries, having taught courses on documentary theory and production at Indiana University. But that's not all that makes him a good candidate for the production of this film. Clift is someone who really enjoys hip-hop music and is also white, a type of person who often faces a certain degree of scrutiny depending upon how, quote, black that person is perceived by others to be acting if they choose to imitate what they've seen and heard through hip-hop. What's really troublesome is when a white rapper is obviously imitating hip-hop culture through their lyrics and behavior, but does not see a need to acknowledge the fact that they did not face the same oppression that is at the very root of what gave rise to hip-hop, the culture in which they are trying to be legitimate. This is exactly where this film begins, with a white rapper named Automatic in a rap battle in Bloomington, Indiana. When it's his opponent's turn, the person he's battling raps that Automatic should, quote, stop acting like he's black. To which Automatic later says, I forgot I was white. After hearing this, some would say, is that so wrong? Rapping shouldn't be about the color of your skin, while others would say, only white people have the luxury of being able to forget the color of their skin. And so does Automatic view himself as black? These types of questions often make people uncomfortable, and because they may not have a solid opinion on the matter, or they may wonder why those questions need to be asked at all. This first scene with Automatic was a very powerful one and really presents the audience with a lot to contemplate within the first few minutes. To have a base for understanding and answering these questions, one must go back to the early 1900s and watch the performances of a well-loved theatrical performer named Al Jolson, in which he wore what's called blackface. And that's exactly where Clift takes us. To summarize, blackface is when a performer paints their face darker in order to appear black and was originated in the minstrel show. The minstrel show, or minstrelsy, was a form of American entertainment that involved white people performing skits and songs in blackface based on racist stereotypes of black Americans. These shows and songs presented black people as slow-minded and often included recurring characters, such as slaves who were perfectly fine with being slaves, and lighter-skinned women who were portrayed as being promiscuous. Minstrelsy slowly became less popular, but its stereotypes and blackface lingered on with Al Jolson, and not to mention the rest of white culture at the time. The popular opinion about blackface and minstrelsy today is that it's a racist mockery of black culture and music. But this film begs the question, is white people identifying with and performing hip-hop like modern-day blackface? Two white parody groups, Cracked Out and Two White Crew, were interviewed and presented with some of these questions. Cracked Out is formed by two men who come out wearing baggy clothes and chains and profess their love for crack cocaine in a comedy sketch. Two White Crew performs popular hip-hop songs while dressed in a similar attire as Cracked Out, but with the added punch of drinking 40s on stage. Both groups claim that they don't take themselves too seriously, with Cracked Out suggesting that the people who find their performances offensive are in fact the racist ones. Cracked Out says that people becoming offended by their performances means they think the performances present a realistic picture of black people and therefore must believe in popular black stereotypes. But that suggestion doesn't hold up to scrutiny. If Cracked Out's performances aren't taking wisecracks at hip-hop culture, then who exactly are they imitating and poking fun at? Other white hip-hop artists who are in turn copying what they've seen black artists do? Power, a black hip-hop artist from Wu-Tang Clan, gives his answer. He says, it's like our music is a way for them to be hood without ever actually experiencing being a real product of the hood. An aspect of this film that I enjoyed most and is its inclusion of interviews and opinions from celebrated black hip-hop artists and comedians such as Power, Chuck D from Public Enemy, and comedian Paul Mooney, among others. A consensus between them all is that white men find in hip-hop music a license to be as macho as possible, and that they often present a very narrow representation of hip-hop. Chuck D, when asked about white hip-hop performers, says, yes, it's contemporary minstrelsy, of course, but the thing that allows minstrelsy to exist in the first place is exploitation. This was a very important point for me in this film because that line really made me think about how and why certain music is popularized. For decades, white people have controlled what's popular in music because they are often the ones with enough money to do so and have a connection to an audience with purchasing power, which has historically been a white audience. I would recommend Blacking Up, hip-hop's remix of Race and Identity, to anyone who's interested in the culture of hip-hop and white appropriation. This is an eye-opening film that really brings to light serious issues that are often overlooked, and one that has personally encouraged me to consider and conduct some of my own research. I have definitely drawn my own opinions from this film, and to close, I will quote a powerful line from comedian Paul Mooney, a line that became my favorite of the entire film. He says, "When white people start getting shot in the back by police and hung just for being white, they can do all the hip-hop they want." This has been a review of Robert A. Cliff's film, Blacking Up, Hip-Hop's Remix of Race and Identity, with Kara from the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Kara. I'm Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Up next, I'm going to play two songs that are critical of liberalism, but in a fairly specific and unconventional sense. It has to be remembered that they are critical of liberalism as leftists because of its historical ties to imperialism and capitalism, not the reactionary screeds of Bill O'Hannity, Ann Coulter, or Chuck Norris. Phil Oakes' 1966 Love Me, I'm a Liberal was a jab at pro-establishment liberals who were anti-communist, pro-war, fore-narking on radicals, and publicly for civil rights while privately hesitant about integration. I was talking to a wobbly woman the other day about updating the song, and, well, I think I found just the next best thing. It's a single released earlier this year by acoustic punk band Mischief Brew called Free Radical Radio Fever. The chorus makes a rhetorically ironic and yet all too serious point of agreement with a character called Mr. Talk Radio, referring to conservative talk radio personalities, but it is anything but what liberals today would call bipartisan.
I go to civil rights rally, and I put down the old D.A.R. D.A.R., that's the Dykes of the American Revolution. I love Harry and Sidney and Sammy. I hope every colored boy becomes a star. But don't talk about revolution. That's going a little bit too far. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. I cheered when Humphrey was chosen, my faith in the system restored, and I'm glad that the commies were thrown out from the AFL-CIO board. And I love Puerto Ricans and Negroes as long as they don't move next door. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Ah, the people of old Mississippi should all hang their heads in shame. Now I can't understand how their minds work. What's the matter, don't they watch Les Crane? But if you ask me to bust my children, I hope the cops take down your name. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Yes, I read New Republic and Nation, I've learned to take every view. You know, I've memorized Lerner and Golden. I feel like I'm almost a Jew. But when it comes to times like Korea, there's no one more red, white, and blue. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. I vote for the Democratic Party. They want the UN to be strong. I attend all the Pete Seeger concerts. He sure gets me singing those songs. And I'll send all the money you ask for. But don't ask me to come on along. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Sure, once I was young and impulsive, I wore every conceivable pin. Even went to socialist meetings, learned all the old union hymns. Ah, but I've grown older and wiser, and that's why I'm turning you in. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal.
sit down. Your name is on the table between the graves and cradles for both the old and new. Wait your turn and smile for the papers. The senders and the shapers will have to wait with you. And shake the hands of masters while outside insurrection. The South can't be mistaken, so pretend like you don't know them. And say you're gonna be on it, you're ready for some peace. And who can argue with that argument when no one says a thing? Come kneel down and beg for some redemption. You finally learned your lesson, and this is how we change. Not here nor there, no patriot or traitor. You've learned to sit for supper and you're sleeping in your cage. It's politics as normal, it's votes and views and morals, none of which mean nothing to the people kept in storage. Who wake up in the morning, the nights are in your hands. At least the smashers and the crashers know exactly where they stand. Hey, Mr. Talk Radio, for once we agree that we can't afford no liberals in times like these. On a feet or on a backs and they're on their knees. No, we can't afford no liberals in times like these. Come lay down, they'll put you underwater. Plan for a natural world order, free trade across the borders, gas efficient war machine. The dead tree needs a trimming, the poison earth needs weeding. Your houses are sinking in the sea, they are rising. It's all so inconvenient, let's all do what we can. And so it's business as usual, give the liberal.
You are tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Mischief Brew with Free Radical Radio Fever. And before that, Phil Oakes singing Love Me, I Am a Liberal. Tom Becker now reads from an article from Truth Out that contextualizes Monsanto among other death-dealing capitalist industries, from tobacco to lead and asbestos. Stay tuned to hear also why you shouldn't work for the NSA and how the surveillance state can help you set up Get Your Garden Started.
What are you doing with the Daily Worker?
Your net must have left it here.
Your boyfriend reads the Daily Worker? What is he, a communist?
He reads everything, you know. Ned's very well read.
Maybe he's just very well read.
Have you been shocked by the ethical bankruptcy that bankers and financiers have shown in their sociopathic quest for profits at any price, regardless of the ruined lives left in their wake? You really shouldn't be. It's been standard operating procedure for corporate capitalism since its inception. For review, I'm going to share with you excerpts from an article by Brian Monick entitled Mankind, Death by Corporation. It's a truthout.org op-ed piece. Ironically, created and managed by humans, Mona begins, corporations have become almost robotic monsters, perpetrating even feeding off human misery, threatening every aspect of human life, the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat, and even the future of mankind itself. What have these corporate Frankenstein monsters done for us lately? At least 1,127 people have died in a collapsed garment factory in Dhaka, Bangladesh, the deadliest such incident in world history. As of this writing, the largest American clothing corporations, Gap, Walmart, and Target, who are the end users of the death trap factories, are still unwilling to commit to any safety improvements. 15 people were killed over 200 injured in West Texas from an explosion at a fertilizer plant. All of these recent tragic headlines have a common denominator. Corporate profits were and are allowed primacy over all other considerations. By rummaging over the current and historical larger-scale threats to entire societies, countries, and mankind in general, we see a grotesque recurrent theme. Corporations willing to kill, maim, and destroy in the name of profit. The science on the broad consequences of cigarette smoking was well established by the early 1940s. Nonetheless, tobacco corporations successfully fought any substantive regulation for the next three decades, while tens of millions of people died early deaths in the name of tobacco profits. Recall the testimony in 1994 from CEOs of the seven largest tobacco corporations before Congress unanimously declaring that nicotine is not addictive, knowing full well that killing people was part of making them rich. Marketing cigarette addiction to children was an integral part of the strategy. But the tobacco industry was no worse than the lead industry in the 20th century. Awareness of lead's serious health consequences, including madness and death, dates back to the Romans, the first to use it extensively. Fast forward to 1980, in paint, gasoline, and a myriad of other products, Americans were using 10 times more lead per capita than the Romans. The average American lost about 6 IQ points from leaded gasoline and paint. Much worse for the nation as a whole, the loss of IQ decreased the percentage of the population qualifying as intellectually gifted by about 40%, and increased the population of mentally challenged by a similar amount. Numerous studies also showed a tight correlation between blood lead levels and aggressive antisocial and criminal behavior. For over 50 years, the Ethyl Corporation, General Motors, Standard Oil, DuPont, and the American Petroleum Institute obscured, obstructed, and lied about the mounting evidence of a public health catastrophe from lead, aggressively marketing it worldwide and fighting every attempt to regulate or curtail its use. By 1898, asbestos was declared in Great Britain to be an extremely hazardous dust. By the 1920s, lawsuits began to be filed against the asbestos industry. The Johns Manville Corporation then successfully lobbied for national legislation, shunting asbestos workers' claims to workers' compensation panels and away from juries. With the industry effectively shielded from costly plaintiff lawsuits, they proceeded to fund medical studies whose published results were falsified, exonerating asbestos as a cause of cancer. When independent studies revealed widespread disease from asbestos, internal corporation members callously mocked their workers. Publicly, asbestos companies claimed there was no evidence people could become sick and die from asbestos exposure. Internally, however, asbestos executives admitted that the disease process begins as soon as asbestos is inhaled, is progressive and irreversible, and is very advanced by the time it is diagnosed. Enter Monsanto. Forbes magazine gave Monsanto its Company of the Year award in 2009. Perhaps it is no surprise that readers of Natural News overwhelmingly awarded Monsanto a slightly different award, World's Most Evil Corporation. What has Monsanto done to achieve this lofty perch? None other than to seek to monopolize the world's food supply with expensive, genetically modified seeds that have to be purchased each year and require expensive and toxic pesticides, which Monsanto also happens to produce. In pursuing this business model, Monsanto has managed to do more damage to the world's food supply and public health than any other single entity. Virtually every branch of U.S. government, including the Supreme Court and the World Bank, has acted as Monsanto's handmaiden, often using taxpayer money to do so. Monsanto's ruthless business practices, high seed prices, and vicious legal attacks have played a key role in the disappearance of small and medium-sized farms, bankrupting small farmers and driving world agriculture further towards huge monocultures and complete control by a handful of agribusinesses and food processing corporations. There is a growing epidemic among small farmers in many countries, especially India, where in the past 16 years, well over 250,000, a quarter of a million, have committed suicide, most of them small cotton farmers where Monsanto controls 95% of the cottonseed and makes its living off suing farmers trapped in debt. That was excerpts from a much longer article entitled Mankind, Death by Corporation by Brian Honnick, a Truthout op-ed piece that can be found on their webpage. Monick is president of Utah's Physicians for a Healthy Environment and a member of the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Why do you think I should work for the National Security Agency?
Well, you'd be working on the cutting edge. You'd be exposed to the kind of technology that you wouldn't see anywhere else because we've classified it. Super string theory, chaos math, advanced algorithms.
Code breaking.
Well, that's one aspect of what we do.
Oh, come on. I mean, that is what you do. You guys handle 80% of the intelligence workload. You're 7 times the size of the CIA.
We don't like to brag about that, Will, but you're exactly right. So the way I see it, the question isn't, why should you work for the NSA? The question is, why shouldn't you?
Why shouldn't I work for the NSA? It's a tough one. But I'll take a shot. Say I'm working at the NSA and somebody puts a code on my desk, something no one else can break. Maybe I take a shot at it, and maybe I break it. And I'm real happy with myself because I did my job well. But maybe that code was the location of some rebel army in North Africa or the Middle East. And once they have that location, they bomb the village where the rebels are hiding. 1,500 people that I never met, never had no problem with, get killed. Now the politicians are saying, oh, send in the Marines to secure the area. It won't be their kid over there getting shot, just like it wasn't them when their number got called because they were all pulling a tour in the National Guard. It'll be some kid from Southie over there taking shrapnel in the ass. He comes back to find that the plant he used to work at got exported to the country he just got back from, and the guy who put the shrapnel in his ass got his old job because he'll work for 15 cents a day and no bathroom breaks. Meanwhile, he realizes the only reason he was over there in the first place was so that we could install a government that would sell us oil at a good price. And of course, the oil companies use a little skirmish over there to scare up domestic oil prices, a cute little ancillary benefit for them, but it ain't helping my buddy at $2.50 a gallon. They're taking their sweet time bringing the oil back, of course. Maybe they even took the liberty of hiring an alcoholic skipper who likes to drink martinis and play slalom with the icebergs. It ain't too long till he hits one, spills the oil, and kills all the sea life in the North Atlantic. So now my buddy's out of work, he can't afford to drive, so he's walking to the job interviews, which sucks because the shrapnel in his ass is giving him chronic hemorrhoids, and meanwhile he's starving because every time he tries to get a bite to eat, the only blue plate special they're serving is North Atlantic scrod with Quaker State. So what did I think? I'm holding out for something better. I figure while I'm at it, why not just shoot my buddy? Take his job, give it to his sworn enemy, hike up gas prices, bomb a village, club a baby seal, hit the hash pipe, and join the National Guard. I could be elected president.
And I guess pretty soon I'll be headed back to Spokane, take up my task of wintering in, and I do a little light farming or heavy gardening, whichever. You know, that kind of farming is hard if you're in this traveling profession, and of course when you sing like I do, you got to be ready to travel with considerable alacrity. I got a Greyhound bus ticket in my back pocket all the time. But you see, quite often I'm not back in town in time for my plowing or my planting. That's awful. But now, one time I was sharing a platform in New York City, it was, with a bunch of high-powered labor politicos. It was a benefit for the farm workers, that's what it was. I remember Richard Chavez, Cesar's brother, was there. And so was Bella Abzug, former congresswoman from the state of New York. Remember her?
Yes.
Wonderful woman. I mean, she was loud, vociferous. Big hats. She was yelling at that audience, righteous beef it was, about how the feds, the FBI, had been opening her mail for ever so long. Well, I knew the feds had been opening my mail for at least 20 years, reading all my personal radical mail, and it never bothered me because I figured them birds had to learn that stuff somewhere, and it might as well be from my mail. But then it occurred to me in my predicament, having the FBI open your mail might come in handy. I sent Sheila, my partner, a letter through the United States Mail, and I said in it, "For God's sake, don't plow up the backyard. That's where the guns are buried." National Guard rolled up, dug up the whole backyard in time for me to come back and plant the damn thing. Oh, I went to a bar and I asked for a drink. He gave me a glass and he showed me the thing. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, all again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Whenever I get all the money I earn, the boss will be broke and to work he must turn. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, all again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. And why don't you save all the money you earn? If I didn't eat, I'd have money to burn. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
You are tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour, and that's all the time we have for today. That was Utah Phillips singing Hallelujah, I'm a Bum, and before that, a clip from Matt Damon's film Good Will Hunting. He is telling you why you should not work for the NSA. Thanks to Bill Resnick and John Bellamy Foster, Kara Dugas, and Tom Becker. Musical selections today were from Defiance Ohio, Mischief Brew, and Phil Oakes. Today's show can be found in a day or two by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or watch for the links posted on our Facebook page, which you should friend us if you already haven't. KBU is supported primarily by its members, so thank you also to existing members, and if you'd like to join, go to the KBU website and click the Donate Today button in the top, in the upper right-hand corner. Tune in next week for news, reviews, interviews, and critical analyses that burrow beneath the surface left untouched by mainstream media. For the Old Mole, I'm Joe Clement. Coming up next, Air Cascadia, with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Locus Focus host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Ashland-based ecologist Dominic DeSala about how climate change raises new challenges for managing and protecting our federal lands and what practices put fragile landscapes at risk. At 11 on Health Watch, host David Naiman interviews family physician Daphne Miller, author of Pharmacology, which is based on Miller's travels to discover the hidden connections between how we care for our bodies and how we grow our food. And at 11:30, Will Hall, host of Madness Radio, asks, how can we better understand the behavior of elders experiencing forgetfulness, Alzheimer's, and dementia? His guest, Stan Tomandel, specializes in this issue. And thanks again to KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm.
Community Radio is proud to broadcast the 26th annual Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. Thursday through Sunday, July 4th through 7th, KBOO will be broadcasting live from Tom McCall Waterfront Park for the Portland metro area and throughout the state with our partners in Ashland, Bend, Newport, Salem, Warm Springs, and more. Internet listeners can tune in to KBOO.fm. Again, that's the 26th annual Waterfront Blues Festival, a benefit for the Oregon Food Bank, because no one should be hungry. More information on costs, benefit to KBOO members, performing artists, and more can be found at KBOO.fm.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, July 1st,